Hello, everyone. This is Lynn Dierking.
Welcoming you to hopefully what will be a full hour radio show this afternoon. I will be honest, I am having some trouble getting into the system. For some reason, it is not wanting to accept my username and password. So I'm going to be needing some help. Hopefully, Lena and Michelle is on the line and can actually help with that portion, because it's going to be really hard for me to know who's calling in and even to speak to them. Can you guys hear me? Well, I'm not hearing from anyone. I have sent emails. Oh, here. Okay, I am trying to rectify this right now. So let me see what I can do here. Let's see. So sorry. I did not allow enough time for myself to prepare this time. Okay, hopefully this will now work. It is not working, so I do not know what the problem is. Let's see. Let me try. I'm going to keep trying. Can Lena or Michelle let me know if they can hear me? That would be really helpful, because then I'll just keep on keeping on, and I won't we'll just do it this way rather than trying to have me. Oh, but I can't let them speak, can I? Sorry, I'm thinking out loud here. It's not a pretty thing. I know. Let's see what I can do here. I'm still trying. It is still not allowing me to. Okay, I'm trying to rectify this, and it's hard for me to, to talk and type things to the team at the same time. So I'm going to, I'm gonna see if I can send let's see. I know you can hear me, so let's see. Michelle, I'm going to see if you can host. I'm sending you the information, and maybe then I can call in as a participant, and we'll sort it through that way. We'll just try it once, and otherwise we'll go back to me doing it and just speaking and not having any ability to see who wants to talk. So sorry, gang. I am working on the Science Learning Plus project. I think I mentioned it to you in my introduction, and I was very involved in working on it today, and then looked at the time and said, oh my goodness, I need to get into the radio show. And everything would have gone smoothly, I think, if it would have accepted my my username and password. But for some reason, I even had Michelle send me the proper one, and it's still not working. So we'll see if she can do this, and if not, I will hear Lena. What is Lena saying? Be in the host queue. Okay. Yeah. I cannot. So I think what I am going to do until I hear from Michelle to see if Michelle can get into the system is I'm just going to keep on going. How about that? And once again, I really apologize. Clearly, I'm not as facile at talk show radio as I should. I've done it several times, but every term I start at the beginning again, and so I apologize for that. Well, I want to welcome you to the course, and I believe, if I recall, what we ended up managing to do last time was we got a little bit of the way through the syllabus and talking about the project. So let me finish that up, and let me find that information in front of me. Again, I apologize. I need to, I'm teaching you an important lesson. You have to give yourself enough time for things not to go the way you plan for them to go. But all of you are experienced teachers and facilitators, so I know you know that already. At any rate,
Alan, hello, Lynn.
Yes.
Hi, it's Michelle.
Oh, great.
I am in. I'm going to make myself and Lena available to talk. So, Lena, I'm taking you off of mute. And I am on screen and can manage any callers from here as we go. So I'll just try and keep
wonderful.
You notified if we have a caller.
This is wonderful. Thank you so very, 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 very much. Okay.
Michelle
has solved the problem for us. At any rate, I think we were talking about Module 3. And as I said, this is an interesting assignment in that what you'll be doing is looking at, it's actually a video of a program that is on public television, and you're going to do what's called a conversation or discourse analysis, and in particular, because the focus of this module is on issues around gender and race and class and agency, and as I said, you'll know what those words are by the time you get to this assignment. Actually, you'll be looking at this show and doing an analysis of it based on looking at things like gender and race. Class, if you can figure it out. So, and I think I reminded you that now you can see why that video observation, which is a part of the module we're on now, is an important step to beginning to sort of have an opportunity to look at video. And thank you so much, Lena. I saw that you made a little note today about the video observation and gave a prompt about what to comment about. I really, really appreciate that. And then, honestly, for the rest of the term in Module 4 and Module 5, in terms of assignments, we're really going to begin to focus on a final project that you'll be creating. And this final project actually is creating a proposal and then actually implementing an observational study of some kind. I've begun talking to some of you individually, in particular in your introductions, and have even suggested to a few of you that you might want to think about projects that are involved either with your workplace or to call Cheryl out. She was talking about working on Science Olympiad, and I was saying maybe you could figure out a way to do your project around that. I suggest this for two reasons. One is so many of you are saying, I'm taking this course because of my work, and I want to better understand sociocultural dimensions of learning so that I can improve the way that I deal with these issues in my day-to-day work. So what better way to do that than to focus on your work? And then the other thing, honestly, has everything to do with your time. And likely it's much easier to be able to focus on something in your own workplace. But something that we will also talk about in Module 4 is looking at institutions and the sociocultural perspective. So we'll be looking a little bit at certainly designed spaces like museums and aquariums and zoos, but also thinking about organizations also, like after-school settings, thinking about community-based organizations, Boys and Girls Clubs, and how they, on the ground, deal with sociocultural perspectives. So that's the term, and I hope you see that we've really, really tried. There have been about three of us who have collaborated on the development of this course over the time since the program started about 7 years ago. We really have tried to be thoughtful about, as I said on Tuesday, thinking about that macro sociocultural dimension, but also thinking about the micro level as well. So talking about these larger issues, culture, all these various ways that we interact, as well as thinking about the more micro level stuff that happens on the ground. I mean, how do families interact when they're in a setting like a museum? What are the roles that youth take in an after-school program? We'll be dealing with stuff like that. So that's sort of an overview. It's very, very quick of the class, and I think what we will now do is move on to some of the questions that were posed to us, some of them that are really fun, talking about career issues, and then some that get into a little more detail. But I will let you know that if you are interested in either sending a question via email or calling in with a question that's specifically about the course, that you should feel really comfortable to do that. In fact, let me call out the the guest call-in number is 347-202-0449. Should you want to call in and ask any questions. And remember, you can also do that on Blackboard or send individual emails to us. So I'm going to turn to the questions that that people sent, which were really great ones. And I'm going to get my myself a little more organized by putting first Lena and then Michelle a little bit on the spot so that I can have a breather here, because it's been a little hectic as I was trying to do this. So one of the questions I wanted to that actually someone was really interested in knowing Lena and Michelle, so Lena will take a crack at it first, is how do you see your career progressing as a result of studying free choice learning? And then how do you hope to apply it to your work? And so, Lena, I'll let you take a crack at that. How about that?
Sure, sure. Can you hear me?
I certainly can, and hopefully
okay.
Everyone else can.
Okay, great. Just making sure. Okay, so to give you a little bit of my background, I am a clinical sciences educator, so I actually teach for a local college, and I also was teaching one day a week with the 4-H program, and 4-H is a youth development program, and there is a trained educator in every county of the state, and they are supposed to provide some positive youth development practices to the area. And so at the time, I desired very much to be a 4-H youth educator. And so, but to become an educator, you needed your master's degree. And of course, if you want to usually teach any higher level courses on the college level, you also need your master's degree. So I saw studying free choice learning as a fantastic way to really broaden my thinking in an academic world, which is, you know, really rather traditional thinking. And so I thought, oh, free choice learning, that would probably help the classes that I teach on the college level. And then, of course, because 4-H is a free choice learning venue, it would really help in my youth development programs to be able to understand my learners a whole lot better. I think the nice thing about studying free choice learning is it really looks at all the different ages, all the different cultural backgrounds, and really brings in the family structure, which might be missing from some traditional K through 12. So through the course of studying the free choice learning, you guys will also take classes with teachers. And so it's wonderful because then you actually get the perspective that teachers come at with and all of their rules and regulations that they need to meet. But I think the nice thing about studying free choice learning is that you can look at it, I guess, without so many standards and administration that way breathing down your back. You have a little bit more freedom to look at the six strands of science learning, which incorporates motivation and interest and excitement, and is often what the teachers are looking for in the classroom, but sometimes can't always provide it just because of the amount of material that they need to cover. And that's where we get to come in and make the experience so amazing. But then we get to add in parents and grandparents and things like that too. So how do I see my career progressing? Oh, goodness, there are so many amazing opportunities out there. I think with anyone with a master's in free choice learning, because not only can you work in traditional educational environments like colleges and universities, but there's so many places where people have fun and enjoy learning, nature centers and things like that. I think there's a lot of wonderful opportunities out there. And so I hopefully will get to work somewhere specific in STEM. I'm very interested in science creating curriculum, and so I look at myself as designing camps and things like that someday, and really getting kids in the mix of some sort of crime scene science type of thing. So it also says, how do you hope to apply it to your work? I look at my work a lot more I think, holistic now. I think one of the things that I learned is that there's a lot of amazing research out there. And so if you want to change something about your practice, you kind of wonder, well, what are the best methods out there? For example, I was looking at Lego robotics, and I wanted to teach some different classes to kids about Lego robotics, and I did some research on it, and there is a wealth of information, and that really helped develop my practice, so that way I could take some of the lessons that they learned from their research, and I could just directly apply it and use wonderful standards of practice. I think all of my activities I designed with a better purpose. You know, I looked at, you know, a lot of times you design something and you go, oh, okay, well, I need to have objectives and I hope they meet the objectives. But what kind of behaviors are we really looking for that match those objectives? So when you go through the different curriculum development classes and you learn about people's actions and social development in this class, you create activities and questions that are much more purposeful. They're usually more open. They're more. You learn that you need to try to draw out people's misconceptions about different things to draw them in and get them excited. So
yeah.
I don't know. I learned amazing things.
I have one question for you, because, you know, you're talking about the work you were doing before, but we've had an interesting conversation, at least on email, about the work you're doing now and the interest the hospital has in you know, providing more educational opportunities for patients. As someone who has been in a couple of situations where I've been the caretaker for sick people, I know I always appreciate learning a little bit more about how to do that. Are you seeing it connect to the work you're doing at the hospital now?
Yes. So recently I just changed out of teaching into the college classroom, and I decided to follow some of my passions. So there's a weird quirk when you get to be such a science-y geek, in that you teach it for a while, and then you're like, oh, man, you know, I want to see the new crazy infectious stuff that's coming out there. So now I'm back working in the microbiology lab. And what I see in healthcare is that I look at it completely different now with new eyes. It's a different kind of free choice learning environment, but not necessarily free choice, but it is often a learning environment. And there's, you know, patients are learning about their diagnoses, you know, firsthand from nurses and physicians who necessarily are not trained in education or educational abilities whatsoever. And I am hoping that then I will be teaching our staff, and then hopefully moving on to be able to teach nursing staff and things like that, who are not trained in educational principles, how to properly educate their patients. And then that should improve workplace training. Yeah, there's a lot of things, I think, in the healthcare field that could really benefit from people who have more of an educational background instead of such a clinical background as medical doctors and things like that, to be able to properly communicate with their patients and teach them.
Yep. Actually, one of our doctoral students is getting a minor in public health because she's real interested in that whole intersection between free choice learning and public health. And a few years ago, we had a master's student who was actually a vet tech. And she realized that she spent most of her time talking to the animals' owners about how to take care of them. And so she, you know, she didn't need to learn how to make a lesson plan or do a more standard kind of education, but she certainly needed to understand how to motivate pets' owners to take better care of their pets. So I just thought that I'd push on you a bit, because I think that if we think really broadly about free choice learning, there are just so many places that it can apply. But I want to give Michelle a chance to talk to us about her her feelings about this. So, Michelle, do you want to share?
Yeah, so I feel like I might be a unique case. I know, at least when I started the program, that not everyone came to studying free choice learning because they already worked in a career relating to free choice learning. And I am one of those. So my mom actually always jokes that I'm going to go from a student discount to a senior discount because I've been in school for so long. But I have not taken a break. I have moved from high school to undergraduate to a master's degree and straight on to a PhD. So I guess I really like to learn. The only prior experience I had working in a free choice learning setting was when I was a volunteer naturalist at a city park when I was an undergraduate student. And it was actually that experience that brought me into the program. So when I was applying to different graduate programs and actually to veterinary medicine schools, I wanted to go into hard sciences. That's the type of program that I was applying to. But at the end of my application, I had written a statement that what I thought was really interesting was how scientists could bring science to communities. I really saw the impact of that in the Nature Center that I was a volunteer naturalist at. And so talking to the environmental sciences department here at Oregon State University, they encouraged me to talk to Sean Rowe, saying, well, he does a lot of that type of work, so why don't you talk to him about being your advisor? And I did, and he and I started working together years ago now when I started with my master's degree. And if you would have asked me if this is where I would be 8 years ago, I wouldn't have guessed it. I love the path that I'm on, but I just would have never known this is the path that I was going to take. So I can't say that my career has progressed because of studying free choice learning, but I can somewhat answer the second part of that about applying it to future work. So as a graduate student, I have been given a lot of opportunities to work as an external evaluator, and that has set me up, I think, in a way that has allowed me to work in a lot of different environments. So I've worked on partnerships with museums and with a school district here in Oregon, from everything from teacher professional development to evaluating an after-school program around the STEAM field, so including the arts and STEM, to museum exhibit evaluation. And I think it's all of those, and along with the classes that I've taken here, that has given me the ability to move into working in a free choice learning setting after graduation. So I hope that's kind of my little unique case, but I hope it's helpful.
Yeah, well, actually, I think it's funny. Most of the people in the course this term, in this particular course, seem to already be working in settings, but that's not always been the case. And so it's great that there are different entry points. Many of our students use this opportunity to get into the field or, as Lena was saying, just move up in the field because it's helpful to have a master's degree.
I was going to say, and that's certainly the case with our certificate students as well, just as the certificate being a professional development, essentially, for all of these people already working in the field who just want to learn more about each of these, you know, the contextual model of learning and the electives that we offer as an evaluation and developing curriculum. So certainly they find it helpful to move up in their jobs as well.
Yep, thank you. And once again, I'm delighted, and hello to all you certificate people out there. So speaking of that, I got a question, and I'll share with you what my question was. I have a few others too, but the first one was, over the course of my career, what has been the most significant or surprising discovery you have made in your research? And then what result was most meaningful? So that's a big question, but it was interesting. It didn't take me very long because I've done a lot of different work, but I wanted to share an example which actually was both significant, somewhat surprising to me, which may be related actually very much to this course in terms of assumptions that I was making, but it also, and it's been a very meaningful finding for me that I've used throughout my career. So the story I want to tell you about actually in some ways is interesting because I was both a researcher on the project, but I was also developing the project. And I think that is really something interesting as some of you all think about your careers. There are these interesting spaces where you can be both a researcher but a practitioner also. I think it's easier for us sometimes to do that in the free choice learning arena. So what I was working on, I had a National Science Foundation grant. It was called Ask with Science. And the ask was adult supporting kids with science. And we were working with, it was a pilot project, and I was working in, I was living in Annapolis, Maryland at the time. And the goal of the project was to work with some communities that had not traditionally perhaps been engaged in science. And by the way, this project had nothing to do necessarily with museums. I mean, it was about approaching parents in particular through organizations that worked with parents. And so we were working with the Boys and Girls Club, an organization. It's a national organization, but it has separate chapters in communities. And it's a drop-in program for families, often families that are living in under-resourced, you know, neighborhoods. And there was a group of moms that I was working with that were in a Moms and Pops program. And this was a program through the YWCA. And it was a program designed for mothers, many of whom were quite young, who either had been abusive to children or had grown up in abusive households. And there was a concern about repeating the cycle. And there was even a young woman in the course who was pregnant with her first child, but she had grown up in that kind of environment. And so they wanted to have her take this Moms and Talks program. Basically, what the program was a parenting education program. And appreciate, you know, I'm a free choice learning person, and I felt very comfortable working with the Boys and Girls Club. And I actually felt comfortable thinking about working with this Moms and Tots program. But there was one aspect to the program that I was a little concerned about, and that was the fact that four mothers who had been incarcerated or had been abusive to their children, this was not a free choice option. It sort of goes back to what Lena was talking about, and actually a conversation I've had on the side with Roxanne about, so what is this free choice learning anyway? Is it totally free choice? I was really concerned that these mothers might not be as motivated to take this class because they actually had to take it. You know, it was part of, if they had been incarcerated, it was part of their caseworking situation. For women who had been abusive, it was something they had to do. And so I remember there were three of us working on this project, and we started doing this class. The focus of our effort was to teach parents about actually at the time, which they are no longer the standards, but about the national science education standards. And what we wanted to impress upon parents is not that they help their children do well in school, but that in fact, because actually in this case many of the children were quite young, but that there was a role parents could play in supporting their young children's focus on these standards that had nothing to do about testing. You know, it was about helping children see the natural world and observe and notice things. And so anyway, with a little bit of trepidation, the three of us went in to work with this group of mothers. And all I can say is that it was a life-changing, transformational experience for me. I may get a little choked up, so be prepared for that. Because actually, rather than these young women, you know, not wanting to be there, actually what these young women wanted to do was to learn how to be a good parent across the board. And they were so committed. And actually the other thing that I learned in this project, by the way, is the power of science. Actually, these women had had very horrible experiences in science. Most of them, their only experience had been in the science classroom. And, you know, these were not women necessarily from backgrounds that loved school. What was fascinating to see is that once they realized, oh, this isn't about memorizing facts. This is about asking questions and being curious. You could not stop these women. They were so excited. And by the way, that's something that I've learned in a number of family-focused projects is sometimes the most excited learners are actually the adults who have not always had hands-on experiences or had a chance to do real science versus just reading a book and having to memorize things. And so what was wonderful is that some of my assumptions about, these are going to be people who feel like they have to be here, so they're not going to be all that interested, both in the content or in learning how to do this with their children at home. That was not the case at all. A couple of great things, sort of anecdotes, but these were really important, and I'll share why this has been transformational for me when I finish these. As these women became more comfortable with us, they actually began to be able to ask questions. And the way we had organized this this set of sessions was that we organized them around the different categories of the standards. And one of them was life science. So we go and we're, you know, doing our intro and we're talking about life science. And one of the women raised her hand and said, you know, and by the way, by the end of the time, they were not raising their hands, which was great. But she said, can I ask this question? And we said, sure. And she said, so why do they call it life science when all you do is dissect dead things? And it was one of these moments when I thought, oh, my goodness. If you think about someone who's not a science person and think about their experience with life science, guess what? That's what it feels like. It was so useful to think about, wow, how do you frame these ideas? And what do you do with groups? And why do you only look at dead stuff? Why do you not talk about life? So that was a great example. The other thing that I learned was how difficult many of these women's lives were. Many of them, by the way, had children, but they were not married, and they still lived at home.
And, you know, we had all these great ideas. We were going to do, you know, we were going to do cooking science, and we were going to do bathtub science, very middle class things. And quickly what we discovered was women saying to us, well, you know, I just have one room in the house that's mine that I can really do things in and where I can make a mess, and that's my bedroom. If I went into the bathroom and was doing, you know, like bathtub stuff, and there was a sense on the part of my parents that I was making a mess, I would be in big trouble. So I can't do that. And it was such a wake-up call. Other women said, you know, food is really scarce in our home, and one of our values around food is that you don't play with it. You don't waste it. And even though it sounds like this would be a great activity, I think that it would be perceived as playing with food. And in fact, I don't think my mother runs the kitchen, and I don't think she's going to let me do something in the kitchen anyway. So you can probably understand. I mean, these were really powerful learnings for me. And as I have moved on from that project and now working closer and closer with communities, I often find myself thinking about these moms. You know, there's often, I go to meetings all the time. I'm working on a project right now in Portland where we're trying to connect what children do in school with what they do out of school. And I go to meetings where very well-meaning people say things like, these parents don't care about their kids, or they don't care about education. And, you know, these experiences that I've had have allowed me to step back and say, well, first of all, maybe there's other education besides school. Some of these parents work 3-4 jobs, maybe coming to a PTA meeting or coming to an after-school, meeting to talk about the child doesn't fit into their schedule, and that can be really difficult for them. So maybe they're not coming, not because they don't care, but because they can't afford to come. But also, I think it's a huge thing to say that they don't care about their children. And so it's just been so helpful for me to always sort of step back and question my assumptions, and to actually be an advocate for parents who are often in these communities that, you know, the idea of being an engaged parent is that you volunteer in the classroom or you make cookies for the bake sale, but that may not be something that fits into your lifestyle. And in fact, I even had a doctoral student actually at University of Maryland who did a study where she looked at trying to reframe parent engagement more from the perspective of the parents than from the, you know, the perspective of schools. At any rate, I've probably gone on longer than I should have, but that was as I said, a pretty meaningful experience for me, and something that I have continued to think about and use and build upon. You know, I that was my first experience, and that was hearing families talk about this. We in this project in Portland, we actually visit families' homes and interview children, some of the children in our study, in their homes, and that gives you a whole other perspective to see how busy and how much is going on in many of these homes. But the thing that I know is that these families care about their children. So, Michelle, my great guide, do we have any other questions, or should I start dealing with the other questions people sent me?
We don't have any questions in the chat box at this time, and we haven't had anybody calling in. Maybe we should repeat that guest call-in for anybody listening live, and that number is 347-202-0449. And then I just have the one question on behalf of the certificate student who posted it in Blackboard.
Great. So, when is she
and we have a caller.
Oh, cool.
Hold on, Lynn, before we go to that, we have a caller. So I am going to unmute you. Who do we have on the line?
Hi, Michelle and Lynn. This is Jamie. How are you doing?
Hi.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. I just am wondering, this is my class four of four for me, and the whole time I've been thinking, you know, all of the museum educators across the country have got to, you know, really get this in their hands and be using these resources. But recently I've been wondering about the general public that visits museums and how valuable it is and for them to kind of understand this field, and you know, is it beneficial for, let's say, a visitor to understand that their motivation for visiting will affect their experience, etc. So I was just wondering some thoughts on that, and or if there are any you know, books or publications that speak to individuals in general that are not in the free choice learning field to understand, you know, some of the research that we have?
That is a great question. And actually, I think it's really important. Actually, as I have grown older and grayer over the course of my career, one of the things that I appreciate that makes free choice learning a little bit different, if you really take it to the extreme, is that you are very open with the goals of learning. And in fact, you know, you really make an effort to have people, whether they're museum visitors or community members, understand what you know, what the goals are. Instead of, you know, it's funny, I think one of the problems with schools sometimes is that, and you know, the truth is kids have figured this out. It's called the hidden curriculum. You know, they know what the real goal here is. But often, you know, there's this sense, oh, we have to figure this out. What does this person want? And so one of the things, as I said, sort of worked a long time in this career, more and more I keep thinking, wow, why don't we invite our learners inside and let them be a part of helping us figure this out? A couple of thoughts. Actually, and, you know, we've been feeling like we need to republish it. John and I wrote a book back in 2002, and it was called Lessons Without Limits, How Free Choice Learning is Transforming Education. And we wrote the book to be a book for regular folk. And the idea was that we had a lot of examples of things you can do with your children. And in fact, the part of the book was about how there are free choice learning goals throughout life. So we have chapters about being middle-aged and what are your free choice learning goals when you're middle-aged. There's a chapter about, you know, being an elder and what are your free choice learning goals at that point in your life. But for whatever reason, I think in part because the book was it wasn't marketed really at all, and it primarily was disseminated through the museum community, who actually, honestly, not everyone got it, because it wasn't just about museums. It was about this idea of lifelong learning and laying out
the perspective. But anyway, we tried that. We actually, every now and then, we get an email from someone who's found the book. And it's really fun, you know. They're very excited, and they want more information on what's going on now. So that's one example. One of the things, I mentioned this project in Portland where we're working on the ground in a community, and we're trying to better connect children's life in school with life out of school. And we're looking at this, we're seeing in our data, it's both a research project and a development project, we're seeing in our data this trend of children that we started following when they were 10 years old, and now they're 13, we're seeing their interest and participation in science and other math dropping. What's interesting is what we decided to do is rather than keep that a secret, we've actually engaged the community in saying, look, this is what the data looks like. This is what's going to happen if we don't do anything. What can we do? Can we change this trend? And what are your ideas about what we could do? And so really trying to engage the community in thinking about that. So at any rate, I think that museums and other institutions and organizations that work with youth and with families, the more they try to engage the learners themselves in thinking about what's going on and learning about, you know, one of the things, and this was the purpose of that, the project I shared as my seminal moment, you know, part of the difficulty is parents think their learning job, and honestly, it is their learning job. They think it is to help their kids do well in school. They think it is to help their kids with homework. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, there are some parents who appreciate that going to a museum or going to a nature center or even going outside on a nature walk is an educational thing. But there are a ton of parents who both don't know that necessarily and or don't think that what they do. There was a really interesting study done. This was about 15 years ago at the Boston Museum of Science, and they were asking, in particular, African-American parents why they didn't use the Science Center. And, you know, most of them thought, oh, it's going to be about the price to get in. And that was certainly, that was one reason. But a lot of parents said the schools take them there. The schools take them on field trips. And, you know, one of the things we'll, you may have already learned in the program, but we probably will talk a little bit about in this class, is there's not a great correlation between children going on field trips to museums with their school class and them becoming lifelong users of places like museums. It's much more likely that that happens if you grow up in a family that takes those kinds of outings. And so there's huge work we have to do to help families know that, well, you know, actually you can do that. And there are programs in many communities that offer discounts or help families who would like to be able to come to these institutions but worry about the financial aspect to allow them to do that. So anyway, thanks. It was a great question.
Thank you.
So, Michelle, you want to ask me my question? Or?
Sure. So this comes from Darwin, one of our certificate students, and he asks, what are your thoughts or experiences on best practices to meaningfully engage individuals with different native or primary language backgrounds in the same free choice learning activity?
Great. And I actually know there was some examples were signs in multiple languages, head, handsets, Native Speaker Guide. One of the comments I was going to make, which probably comes through a lot in the examples I've talked about this evening, is that that sounds like trying to reach these individuals who are visiting in a place, you know, an exhibition or a nature center. And indeed, there's good evidence actually that providing signs in multiple languages is really helpful. Actually, sometimes the families don't even use the multiple language, but they actually, it just makes them feel like someone is thinking about them. But something that I also learned, by the way, in that project in Annapolis was that actually for many of the families that I was trying to reach, whether the language was English or Spanish wasn't going to be very helpful, because actually the families were not necessarily, the adults in the family were not necessarily literate, or if they were, they read at very low reading levels. So I think that one of the things we really have to think about is how do we move beyond beyond words always, and how do we think about, you know, we're lucky if some of these families visit an institution. How do we get people, as I said a few moments ago, to feel like this is a place for them, that there's a role they can play as an educator of their, of their children. I will say, and hopefully you'll be able to be on the radio show when this guest, we're going to have Jill Stein, who I know was a radio show person last quarter, for those of you who took 582. But she's going to be joined, I hope, by Shelley Valdez, who is a Native a woman who does Native approaches to evaluation. And they're going to be talking about a project called Cosmic Serpent, which was an effort to try to pull together Native ways of thinking about science with Western perspectives. And they're going to be talking a little bit. One of the things that happened in that project was they actually had folks from different institutions about efforts. So I know we're sort of running out of time, but there was another question that I had about the fact that in studying family learning in a museum setting, a lot of the work seems to be dated. And the person was saying, do you have specific authors or articles you are aware of that you could recommend that have been published more recently? And just really quickly, there are some articles, but actually, you know, one of the things that's happened in the field, and I'm going to have another guest will be Scott Patterson. I'm still working out the times, by the way, the dates, but one of the things that happened is we've appreciated that by trying to study families in the museum, we're missing a whole lot about their lives and about what makes them, what their motivations and interests are. And so a lot of the research about families is now happening out in communities. And so we can talk a little bit about that. It's not to say that the work that's being done in museums is not important, but it's a real interesting trend in the field. So, we've got 10 seconds. Well, guys, thank you so much for your patience again, and look forward to further radio shows and talking to you online. Bye. Michelle? And Leah?
Yeah.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Cool. That worked pretty well.
Oh. Yes. Do I have to hit end episode in this panel?
Ultimately. But I think, yeah. And I have to figure out what's going on. You know, it's funny that the one you sent me with the hyphen, didn't work the other day, and so I it was some variation, and I thought I tried all of them. You know, putting free choice together, separating it, but the hyphen didn't work. So I've got to figure out. I'll play around with that. I'm so sorry, but thank you for saving me.
Don't worry about it. I'm happy to do it.
Cool. And Lena,
are
you there?
We had a caller.
Yeah.
Hung up.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, thanks. Thank you so much. Now we're even. I screwed up too.
I still feel bad.
Oh, don't. And, you know, I was honest with them. You know, I know there were big gaps of silence, but I was trying to figure out what was going on. But, yeah, I finished something at 1/4 of, and I should have, you know, stopped working on it. And I just thought, oh, you know, this, I know how to do this. So, but I think it worked out
yeah.
all right.
It did. It worked.
Yeah.
So,
well,
all right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
Have a nice evening.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.